Thank you all so very much for coming. It's a beautiful gift of time. Tonight it's a particularly worthwhile gift of time because we have Rabbi Dahlan with us, who really is filled with a great deal of wisdom from the Lord, just as I've experienced him in the last hour or so. He really is a gem, and it's a great honor and a great privilege for all of us to have him in our midst. Patrick Delaney will introduce him formally in just a minute. All I want to do at the beginning, besides welcoming you all and thanking you, is to ask you to join with me in prayer for a moment for dear Bishop Bullock, from whose inspiration this Therese Lecture Series draws its reality, draws its existence. So we thank God for Bishop Bullock, and we ask that the Lord will absolutely pour forth his merciful love upon him now and forever. Eternal rest grant unto Bishop Bullock, O Lord, and a perpetual watch. May he rest in peace. May his soul and the souls of all the faithful departed, through the mercy of God, rest in peace. Amen. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Once again, thank you all for coming. Rabbi, thank you so much. And I'm finished. Thank you.
I may not be Patrick Delaney, but I taught him religion in fifth grade. By the way, you may look at this picture of Rabbi Dahlan in here as well. And he told me that's actually his bar mitzvah picture that's there as well. Or was it your ordination as a rabbi?
Maybe that's closer.
Closer than that as well. Well, a critical thinking has become a lost art in our society. A new study reports that the dismal findings that 45% of college students show no significant improvement in the key measures of critical thinking, complex reading, and writing by the end of their sophomore year in college. During the prior semester, half the students did not take a single course that required 20 pages of writing, and a third did not take a single course that required so much as 20 pages of reading per week. And the study ironically also found that 300,000 bartenders in the United States have college degrees. But we are fortunate tonight to have a critical thinker like Rabbi David Dahlan, who examines the historical facts and critically reflects upon them. In the case of Pope Pius XII, some of the facts that some people think they know about this pope are simply scandalous. And in the words of the Talmud, the slanderous tongue kills three: the slandered, the slanderer, and him who listens to the slander. Rabbi David Dahlan is an American conservative rabbi and historian. He is an author, a co-author of our editor of 10 books on American Jewish history and politics and Jewish-Christian relations. He is currently professor of history and politics at Ave Maria University in Florida. He was previously an associate professor of American Jewish history at the University of Hartford, a visiting professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, and the Taube Research Fellow in American History at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. And during the 2002-2003 academic year, Rabbi Dahlan was a visiting fellow at the James Madison Program in American Ideal and Institutions at Princeton University. His numerous articles and book reviews have appeared in American Jewish History, Commentary, First Things, The Weekly Standard, and the American Jewish Yearbook. He serves as a member of the editorial and advisory board of the journal First Things, of the editorial board of the journal Conservative Judaism, and a member of the Academic Advisory Council of the American Jewish Historical Society. Rabbi Dahlan, a native of San Francisco, received his BA from the University of California at Berkeley and an MA and PhD degrees from Brandeis University, and a second MA and his rabbinic ordination in 1987 from the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. His wife, Marianne, is a professor of history and Jewish studies at Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton. His daughter, Simona, is a student at Brandeis University, and his son, Barry, is a student at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. The Talmud teaches, whoever preserves one life, it is accountable to him by Scripture, as if he had preserved a whole world. Rabbi Dallin, through his scholarly research, believes that more than any other 20th century leader, Pope Pius XII fulfilled this Talmudic dictum, and when the fate especially of European Jewry was at stake. And for this, Rabbi Dallin believes, Pius XII generally and profoundly deserves the honor of being named a righteous Gentile and his name added at the Garden of Righteousness at Yad Vashem in Jerusalem. Thank you, Rabbi Dallin, for being a great thinker and for coming to us to Madison today, and welcome you to our assembly this evening.
Well, first of all, I want to thank Bishop Molino and Father Smith for inviting me to speak and for their gracious introductions. And also, as a new Floridian who grew up in San Francisco, I'm delighted that there was no snow. That I brought my winter coat almost for nothing. In recent years, Eugenio Pacelli, who became Pope Pius XII in 1939, has been the subject of much public criticism and even vilification for his alleged failure to speak out against Hitler during the Holocaust. He's been accused of actually collaborating with Nazi Germany, with the Hitler regime. He's been accused of anti-Semitism. And in 1999, in a book written by John Cornwell, who's ironically a former Jesuit seminarian, he was accused of being Hitler's pope. The cleric closest to Hitler and closest to the Nazi regime and supportive of it during World War II and during the Holocaust years. And what my book is about and what I'm here to talk to you about tonight is to tell you that nothing, really nothing, could be further from the truth. A little bit about the background of dealing with the Holocaust and the loss of Jewish lives that some of you may know. During World War II, probably about 80% of the Jews of Europe, of Nazi-occupied Europe, were killed, were exterminated by the Nazis. At the same time, close to 85% of Italian Jews were saved and rescued. And what I want to suggest to you is that this was not a coincidence. A lot of this had to do, the fact that so many of Italian Jews survived the Holocaust, had to do with the moral courage of Pope Pius XII. Let me give you a few examples. During the period of the Nazi occupation of Rome, from the fall of 1943 until the early summer of 1944, close to 3,000 Jews were hidden and sheltered at Castel Gandolfo, the Pope's summer residence outside of Rome. Now, in no other location, no other site in Nazi-occupied Europe were as many Jews saved and sheltered at one time as they were at Castel Gandolfo. And had they not survived that, they would have been deported to Auschwitz, the Nazi death camp, where they would have lost their lives. During World War II, 155 convents, monasteries, and churches in Rome opened their doors to hide and shelter Jews, as well as several buildings of the Vatican itself. Now, why this is so important, you know, many critics of Pius XII who have alleged that he was Hitler's pope and that he was a collaborator with Nazi Germany have said, well, you know, of course, there were a lot of good Italians who saved Jews, but the Pope had nothing to do with this. On the contrary, the 3,000 Jews who were sheltered at Castel Gandolfo could not have been done without the Pope's directive. He gave personal instructions for this to be done. And incidentally, you should know that some of these Jews were even given kosher food during their stay at Castel Gandolfo. I want to give you a little bit about some biographical background about Pius XII and what he did in his career to save Jews and his relationship to the Jewish community of Italy and of Europe. Now, Eugenio Pacelli, shortly after being ordained a priest in 1901, he joined the Vatican diplomatic service. In fact, he was one of the preeminent Vatican diplomats of the 20th century, and that's why he was elected pope in 1939, just on the eve of World War II, when it was decided that the next pope should be a diplomat, should have diplomatic credentials. Now, from 1917 to 1929, Eugenio Pacelli was a Vatican nuncio, a Vatican ambassador in Germany. And this is, you know, many people who have alleged that he was a supporter of the Nazi regime have given this as his background. But what is often forgotten is throughout the 1920s and throughout the 1930s, on no less than 55 occasions, which I've documented in my book, Eugenio Pacelli spoke out in criticism of attacking the Nazi regime generally and Nazi anti-Semitism in particular. The fact is that if he were the image of Eugenio Pacelli being Hitler's pope, one assumed that he was friendly with Hitler, they got together, they went out for drinks, they had dinner together, etc. Once again, nothing could be further from the truth. Eugenio Pacelli never met Adolf Hitler. He left Germany in 1929, 4 years before Hitler took power, to return to Rome to become the Vatican Secretary of State. He never visited Germany again. He never even met Adolf Hitler. Now, it's interesting, the book by John Cornwell, who I must tell you, is a former Jesuit seminarian who wrote this vicious attack on Eugenio Pacelli. On the cover of the book is a picture of Eugenio Pacelli, and in the background of this picture are uniformed German military with rifles. Now, the caption of this picture in the jacket of the book says this picture was taken in 1939, and therefore the implication is that this was the newly elected pope, Pius XII, and he was waiting in the photograph outside a German government building, supposedly waiting to meet with Adolf Hitler. In truth, this was a picture taken in 1927. In fact, the British publisher of this book, in the next edition, changed the front cover of the book. It was taken in 1927, and the military officers in the background were not Nazi officers, but rather officers of the Democratic Weimar Republic. And Eugenio Pacelli was waiting to meet President Hindenburg of the Weimar Republic, not Adolf Hitler. So this goes to just some of the misconceptions and some of the real falsifying of history by authors and publishers who have tried to portray the future Pope Pius XII as something that he was not, and that, in other words, portraying him as an enemy rather than as a friend of the Jewish people. Now, some other examples that are worth important to talk about. In 1938, when Eugenio Pacelli was still the Vatican Secretary of State, Adolf Hitler made his first very famous state visit to Italy. When he arrived, shortly before he arrived in Rome, Eugenio Pacelli and Pope Pius XI, his predecessor, snubbed Hitler. They left Rome for Castel Gandolfo, the Pope's summer residence. Hitler was furious, and even more so was Benito Mussolini, the Italian dictator, who was ready then and there to arrest the Pope and the Vatican Secretary of State. They didn't for a whole host of reasons that I talk about in my book. But it's important to know that Eugenio Pacelli had the moral courage to publicly snub Adolf Hitler. We now know that the Nazi regime had plans to assassinate Eugenio Pacelli, both before he became pope and Pius XII afterwards. They had plans to kidnap him. Now, there was precedent for this. In 1801, Napoleon Bonaparte attacked the Vatican and kidnapped another Pope Pius and took him back to Rome in exile, in Paris in exile, where he died. We now know that the Nazis had explicit instructions and plans to attack the Vatican and kidnap the Pope in the 1940s. Also, there's a lot of documented evidence that even before he became pope, Eugenio Pacelli went out of his way to save Jewish lives. In 1938, Mussolini, the Italian dictator, put into effect his infamous Jewish legislation, really anti-Jewish legislation, modeled on Hitler's Nuremberg laws. By this legislation, Jews could no longer practice law or medicine in Rome and could no longer attend or teach at any of the state universities. All Jews teaching at the University of Rome and other state universities were summarily dismissed from their positions. Eugenio Pacelli proceeded to give jobs at the Vatican, especially at the Vatican Library, to several professors who were dismissed from their positions, several Jewish professors. And the Vatican, as some of you may know, has one of the foremost collections of Hebraica, of Hebrew manuscripts and books in the world. And these Jewish professors were hired, were appointed to, and were given nice paying jobs at the Vatican until Eugenio Pacelli could arrange for them to get visas, exit visas, to leave for England, for Israel, then Palestine, or for the United States. One of the Jews that he saved, and this is a story that I think I tell for the first time in my book, was his childhood friend Guido Mendes, who was Jewish. Now, Pius XII was the first pope in modern times to have a Jewish childhood friend, a lifelong friend. And his name was Guido Mendes. He was descended from a very distinguished family of Italian physicians. And he and Eugenio Pacelli had been school chums together since elementary school and high school. They remained in touch over the years. And he eventually became, Guido Mendes, a very distinguished professor of medicine at the University of Rome. When he was dismissed from his position, secretly, Pius XII, the future Pius XII, arranged for Guido Mendes and his family to get diplomatic passports to go to Israel, where they settled. Now, it's very interesting how life turns around sometimes. Guido Mendes, on several occasions during the pontificate of Pius XII, revisited Rome and visited with his old friend. And his son, Meir Mendes, became a very prominent professor of political science, specializing in diplomacy at Israel's Bar-Ilan University. And in the early 1990s, when negotiations were underway to establish diplomatic relations between the Vatican and the State of Israel, the advisor to the Israeli government and to the Vatican was Meir Mendes, the son of Guido Mendes, the Jewish friend whose life Pius XII had saved a generation before. Now, there's so many stories to tell about Pius XII. You know, in fact, Father Smith said, as I often say, he was really one of the two great heroes of the Holocaust. Now, in an era like the Holocaust, you can't really talk about heroes when 6 million Jews and several million Catholics and millions of others were killed. And yet there were two people who, above and beyond, went out of their way to save Jews. One was Pius XII, and the other was Winston Churchill. Incidentally, the two of them were lifelong friends almost. They were the exact same age, actually a year and a half apart. They met in 1908 when Winston Churchill was a young member of the British Parliament and Eugenio Pacelli was a young up-and-coming Vatican diplomat visiting England at a conference, and the two of them became fast friends and remained friends for 50 years exactly until Pius XII's death in 1958. Now, to say that Pius XII saved Jewish lives is especially impressive when you compare him to FDR. Now, one of the other books I've written is about the presidents of the United States and the Jews. Now, for my parents' generation, FDR was like a saint. You know, in the 1930s and 1940s, for most American Jews, at a time when Roosevelt was getting 90% of the Jewish vote, to not vote for FDR was tantamount to converting from Judaism. It seemed like all Jews voted for FDR. Only later did Jews learn all the things that FDR and his administration didn't do, should have done, and could have done to save European Jewry during the Holocaust. And yet Pius XII was able, who didn't have the armies, he wasn't the commander-in-chief that FDR was. And, you know, this is a whole nother talk. I would recommend one of my other books on what FDR didn't do. But this is what also makes what Pius XII did so impressive, was that he was one of the few moral heroes of World War II, of the Holocaust era. Now, some of his critics have said that, well, you know, he should have spoken out more courageously. He should have spoken out more publicly. Well, the fact was he was trained as a diplomat, and he did a lot of his work that saved tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Jewish lives behind the scenes. And the example, and it can be said, I think, and documented, that had he tried to speak out too vocally, it might have been counterproductive, especially for the Jews and Catholics of Germany. We know, though, for example, in 1942, there was a papal directive at the requests of the bishops of Belgium attacking Nazi anti-Semitism, which was read in all the churches, the Catholic churches of Belgium, on one particular Sunday. Well, the result of this was not what was expected. The reprisals of the Nazi regime, this was a Nazi-occupied country, were horrific. And a greater percentage of Jews in Belgium, not the greatest number, but the greatest percentage of Jews of any Nazi-occupied country were killed in Belgium because of this. So the argument can be made, and I make this argument in my book, that Pius XII did a tremendous amount diplomatically and behind the scenes, and especially in Italy, to save the Jews of Europe. Now, a couple of other things that are important to remember in all of this. By the way, Pius XII made a famous visit. He was the first future pope to visit the United States. By the way, he was also the first pope to use radio. Some of you may remember hearing about, or even remember, FDR's fireside chats on the radio. And Pius XII spoke to the world via radio, which no other pope had done before. Excuse me once again, my apologies. In 1936, he visited the United States. He toured the United States, starting out in San Francisco. He went to the Grand Canyon, and he went east. The purpose, the visit, had been arranged and orchestrated by Cardinal Spellman in Boston and his good friend Joe Kennedy, the patriarch of the Kennedy family. Why did Eugenio Pacelli, the Vatican Secretary of State, come to the United States? He came to meet with FDR. Why? FDR had requested the meeting. Some of you have heard of Father Coughlin, the radio priest. He was, before we ever had what's known as talk radio today, he was a Catholic radio priest in Detroit, in the Detroit suburbs, who had started out as a great fan of FDR and the New Deal. After 2 or 3 years, he became one of the most vocal and vicious critics of the New Deal and of FDR himself, and became a little more than a little bit anti-Semitic as well, blaming the Depression and the economy on the Jews. Now, he became an embarrassment to the Catholic community of the United States, to the Catholic church leaders of the United States, to the Vatican, and he especially became more than an annoyance to FDR. FDR asked Cardinal Spellman and Joe Kennedy to arrange this meeting because he wanted Father Coughlin taken off the air. He was really afraid. You know, Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal coalition was composed largely of Catholics and Jews, and he was afraid that Father Coughlin would influence, you know, the Catholic vote against him. Well, what's interesting is they met at Hyde Park By the way, not in the White House. In fact, by the way, a sideline here, it's very interesting. Joe Kennedy, who was not a very devout Catholic, certainly, but his wife Rose was, they had, after the meeting at Hyde Park, he had a private railroad car that took the future Pius XII to Riverdale in New York, where the Kennedys were then living, so they could have tea together with Rose Kennedy. And when he eventually became... At his papal inauguration, Joe Kennedy represented the United States with the Kennedy family, including a very young John F. Kennedy, the only future president ever to attend a papal inauguration. But what happened at Hyde Park that day was fascinating, and I think if more American Jews knew about this, they would be very grateful to Pius XII. Pius XII agreed, the Vatican had decided to take Father Coughlin off the air, and as 3 weeks later he was off the air, never to be heard before, FDR was delighted, and there was a bargain struck. The bargain struck was that what would the Vatican get in return? FDR promised that henceforward there would be a American envoy to the Vatican with ambassadorial status, separate from the ambassador to Italy, and we've had one ever since. And I've often said that if more American Jews, they would be tremendously grateful to Eugenio Pacelli for his tremendous role in which he took the initiative in taking Father Coughlin off the air. And by the way, the church hierarchy of the United States was especially grateful for that because he had become such an embarrassment. Now, let me leave you with something else, with some other thoughts. John Cornwell, the leading papal critics of Pius XII were liberal or lapsed Catholics. Now, if Pius XII had really been Hitler's pope, one would have expected the most vicious critics or vocal critics to come from the Jewish community. But no, indeed, they were John Cornwell, a former Jesuit seminarian, Gary Wills, another former Jesuit seminarian, James Carroll, who some of you may know of today, a columnist for the Boston Globe, a former Catholic priest. Their agenda, they were all vicious critics of John Paul II, and their agenda was appropriating or misappropriating the Holocaust to say that if the credibility of one pope, Pius XII, who was an Orthodox Catholic, could be undermined and questioned, then they could all question and undermine the credibility of another pope, Orthodox in his Catholicism, who they detested, John Paul II. And it's more than a coincidence. Each of these papal critics, wrote subsequent books attacking John Paul II. Now, two last points. Actually, one important anecdote before going to my last major point. In 1955, in celebration of the 10th anniversary of the liberation of Rome, the Israeli Philharmonic Orchestra, the Israeli government, the government of Israel, paid for the Israeli Philharmonic Orchestra to go to Rome to play a concert in tribute to Pius XII at the Vatican. Now, this was a tremendously memorable incident because of the following. Since Israel became a state, the state of Israel has never played the music of Richard Wagner, the composer, because of his reputation of being Hitler's favorite composer, a cultural icon of the Third Reich, and a vicious anti-Semite. And there's been a tradition, except for one occasion, his music has never been played in the state of Israel. Now, it is completely incomprehensible. Now, in the 1950s, there was a huge community of Jewish Holocaust survivors living in Israel. It is unimaginable, it is incomprehensible that the Israeli government would have paid for the entire Israeli Philharmonic to go to Rome to play a concert in tribute to a pope who they believed was Hitler's pope. It's just unimaginable. And it's inconceivable because, in fact, the Israeli government was very grateful to Pius XII for what he did to save European Jews during the Holocaust. Another example of this, many of the severest critics of Pius XII also understandably revere Pope John XXIII, as I do as well. Now, many of Pius XII's critics forget, however, that John XXIII was the protege and the hand-picked successor of Pius XII. John the 23rd, also while in World War II, based in Istanbul as a Monsignor, he saved the lives of tens of thousands of Jews at the personal direction and instruction of Pius XII. We now know in 1957, the year before Pius XII died, an Israeli journalist, Pinchas Lapid, and an Israeli diplomat also, visited with the future John the 23rd, who was then the Patriarch of Venice. And he came on behalf of the State of Israel to thank Angelo Roncalli, the future John the 23rd, for all that he did to save Jews during the Holocaust. As he started to thank him, the Patriarch of Venice stopped him and he said, "Please don't thank me. If you're grateful for the Jewish lives that were saved, you have to thank Pius XII. Everything I did was done on his direct instructions, on his direct requests." Finally, I want to give you some thoughts on something else. John Cornwell, in his book Hitler's Pope, claimed that Hitler had a favorite cleric. Well, he was right about that. Adolf Hitler did have a favorite cleric. He was just wrong as to who it was. Hitler's favorite cleric was Haji Amin al-Husseini, the Mufti of Jerusalem, the Arab Mufti of Jerusalem, who spent the Holocaust years in Germany as part of Hitler's inner circle. The villain of the story is not Pius XII, but rather the Mufti of Jerusalem, Haji Amin al-Husseini, who worked very closely with Adolf Eichmann and Heinrich Himmler. He was one of the architects of Hitler's final solution. He went at one point with Eichmann to the Auschwitz death camp and chastised the Nazi leaders for not being efficient enough in their extermination of the Jews. Now, it was Haji Amin al-Husseini who mobilized two Muslim Waffen SS units that were responsible for the mass murder of 90% of European Bosnian Jewry and tens of thousands of Croatian Catholics. After the war, he would have been indicted as a war criminal at Nuremberg, but he escaped and was greeted as a conquering hero. He came back to the Middle East, to Cairo. He was the mentor of a very young Yasser Arafat, who was his cousin. The family name was Husseini, and two generations of young Arab Islamists whose main goal was to destroy the State of Israel. And I could go on and on like this. It was the Haji Amin al-Husseini, by the way, who was responsible for the translation into Arabic and the widespread distribution of Hitler's autobiography, Mein Kampf, and of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. By the way, Haji Amin al-Husseini met with Hitler on many occasions. Eugenio Pacelli never once. It may be of interest to know that there are more today, more thanks to Haji Amin al-Husseini, more Arabic translations of Mein Kampf than there are German translations. One more example of this, Haji Amin al-Husseini, and I'll conclude about Pius XII. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, some of you may be familiar with, is one of the classic tracts of modern anti-Semitism. It was a Tsarist forgery in Russia that purported that there was a Zionist Jewish conspiracy to control the world. There was a small group of Jews who controlled the world. Well, after it was translated into Arabic in the 1960s, it became the favorite book of several Islamist rulers, including Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt and King Faisal in Saudi Arabia. Now, it's very interesting. King Faisal loved the book so much, he made sure that there was a copy of it in every hotel room in Saudi Arabia instead of the Bible. And he made a point of giving it to every visiting diplomat who came to the Saudi capital. In fact, in what I would call one of the monumental examples of chutzpah in modern diplomacy, when Henry Kissinger, Richard Nixon, President Nixon's Jewish Secretary of State, came to meet with King Faisal, King Faisal gave him his own personal copy of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Now, the point of this is, and I want to emphasize this, and I have a chapter in this in my book, that Hitler did have a favorite cleric. It wasn't Pius XII. And rather, on the contrary, Pius XII was one of the great friends of the Jewish people at a time in history when the Jewish people needed friends the most and had them the least. And I want to conclude with one thing, that there were the tributes. I mentioned the tribute of the Israeli Philharmonic Orchestra. Jewish leaders on three continents, in the United States, Israel, and Europe, all spoke out, both at the time of Pius XII's death in 1958 and for years thereafter, praising him and thanking him for all that he did for the Jews of Europe. Now, I would like to close by saying that today, more than 60 years after the end of the Holocaust, Pius XII should be remembered and honored as a righteous Gentile, as a leader, as one of the great moral leaders of Europe during the Holocaust, who through his offices was able to participate and to initiate the rescue and saving of the lives of hundreds of thousands of European Jews. Thank you. How do I do this?
Do you have any comments?
Yeah, I do. I'd like, because Dr. Zola did mention a very important point, which I should have, the deputy. One of the reasons that there's the image of Pius XII of Hitler's Pope, it preceded John Cornwell, but you should let me give the explanation of what the deputy was. The deputy was a very best-selling play that made its debut in Germany. It became very popular in the United States. But Ralph Hochhoff, who was a secular Protestant, who we now know had also been a member of Hitler's youth, he was the writer of The Deputy. He's also emerged, incidentally, in recent years as a Holocaust denier, which I don't know if Dr. Zola knows this. Now, it was The Deputy, which was a work of fiction that portrayed Pius XII as an avaricious cleric who collaborated with Hitler. It's on the basis, and that's why that was 5 years in 1963, and I discussed this in my book, and I appreciate his comment, because I should have noted this, and then I'll talk to you, and then I'll mention your other point. But the fact is, The Deputy was a vicious piece of fiction, and its own producer and writer, Rolf Hochhoff, had an agenda in writing that. And that's what to the extent that there's been an image of Eugenio Pacelli, who people in my generation grew up with, it was from The Deputy. Now, the thing about the Vatican Archives, who knows? The Vatican Archives, they've been opened on a chronological basis. So far, it's only been Pope Pius XI. Now, you're right, it may be, who knows, I may be completely wrong. I don't think I will. The fact was that what Dr. Zola is saying perhaps is true. Maybe you'll go to Rome in 2014 and have access to that. But the point is that we don't, just like State Department archives are kept closed for 50 years, so are Vatican archives. And the assumption by Pius XII's critics is that there's going to be some material that will condemn him so much, that's as likely or unlikely a prospect as there may very well be additional documentation that he indeed did rescue Jewish lives. But to say, the fact is nobody knows. Any more questions? What do you mean? Yes?
Hi. In Belgium, when the Catholic Church... the bishops did the thing that you talked about in the the repercussions on the Jews were a lot rougher there. Did
yes.
anything happen?
And on Catholics too, by the way.
Okay, that was my question.
Yes, in fact, it was Edith Stein, who some of you may know was the famous philosopher, a Jewish convert to Catholicism, that was sent to Auschwitz. The reprisals were equally strong against Catholics and Jews in Belgium. And this was, in other words, some people have said, and I address this in my book, and by the way, I really address the point of the papal excommunication at some length, but people say, what could be worse than the extermination of 6 million Jews? And the answer is hundreds of thousands of more Jews, which might have happened. Now, and I think that's one of the arguments that's always been brought, that the critics of Pius XII don't take more seriously. And in terms of the percentage of Jews and Catholics killed in Nazi-occupied Europe, the highest percentage, not the highest number, but the highest percentage was in Belgium. Any more questions?
Rabbi, there's probably lots of American Jews who are here because they were saved by Pope Pius XII. In light of the harsh criticism of him, why do you think they have been so silent over the years?
It's a good question. I think it's, what's the word? The conventional wisdom. I mean, for example, the books attacking Pius XII have been made fortunes for their authors. They've become New York Times bestsellers. They've been the subject of media attention. There's been, the phrase can be misused, but I think it's politically correct today, in terms of political correctness, to be a critic of Pius XII. And it's, but in recent years, my book is one of a few examples of scholarship that's tried to kind of redirect the balance. And by the way, and I think some people have been, a lot of Jews have been even afraid to criticize FDR, who was considered, considered almost a god in Jewish households. I mean, for many Jews of my parents' generation, it was devastating to realize that all the things that FDR could have done and didn't do to save Jews. And I think that's part of the same thing here, that, when you're raised, and I'm glad Dr. Zola brought out about the deputy, because I should have mentioned that. It was imbibed in our culture since the deputy, more than any other book, the deputy shaped the public image for Jews and liberal Jews and liberal Christians alike of Pius XII. And people forget that the deputy was a work of fiction, which never purported to be more. But it's a very good question. Hopefully my book will help to change opinion a little bit. A
couple of questions. One is, I have a historical recollection that after Kristallnacht, that there was a meeting of prominent American Jews here in the United States, and there was a decision made not to publicly oppose Hitler for the very reason you talked about, because of concerns that if there was this public attack upon Hitler, that it would make it worse for the Jews in Europe. Yeah. And so first of all, that's a historical recollection of mine. I just want to know if, A, you can confirm that. And then the second question is this, is in Europe, certainly if you looked at some of the diocesan papers and other writings of Catholics, there certainly you could see a thread of anti-Semitism in them. And if you look at some of the papers in Poland, et cetera, that there's sometimes...
Oh, yeah, and Austria, too. By the way, just to interrupt you for a minute, there certainly were many Catholics who were anti-Semitic. There's no question. The bishop, one or two of the bishops in Austria and Germany themselves, but that doesn't take away from the argument that I've been making, but yes.
Yes, yeah, so the question then would be, is to what extent would... Pacelli had any influence, say, prior to his election as Pope in terms of perhaps influencing Pius XI in terms of reining in some of the anti-Semitism that was present in Europe? Because obviously, as you mentioned, Eugenio Pacelli helped to rein in some of the anti-Semitism here in the United States in terms of Father Coughlin. And then the second question is, even after he became Pope, was there any effort for him to try to rein in any of this anti-Semitism that might have been prevalent in the diocese? So not that he was saying anything anti-Semitic, but more that...
There was only a limit on what he could do. I don't know. I know there were letters written about, I think it's Bishop Hudal in Austria, who was a very outspoken supporter of the Nazi regime. But no, Pius XII had his greatest leverage within Italy itself, and the few anti-Semitic bishops were in Germany and Austria, and they were completely nothing that he said had any impact. I'd like to address the first quickly what you said. It's not so much an organized Jewish meeting after Kristallnacht. American Jewish leaders were fearful of saying too much because, number one, they heard from relatives in Europe. By the way, I quote in my book, a letter that the Bishop of Munster in Germany, who was imprisoned in Dachau, the German concentration camp, wrote to the Jews of his diocese and the Catholics of his diocese, asking them not to protest too publicly because it would be worse for the situation of Jews and Catholics. But what you were saying about Jews in the United States, there were two things. They were fearful that to say too much might generate greater reprisals by Hitler, but also they were fearful of anti-Semitism in the United States. There was a big German-American Bund that supported Hitler. There was a lot of, this was the days when, you know, Charles Lindbergh was considered at one time the most popular man in America, and Henry Ford, who almost ran for president at one time, were viciously outspoken anti-Semites. There was a lot of concern about anti-Semitism in the United States, but also a lot of the people that the Jewish community believed in. I mean, once again, we now know, you mentioned Kristallnacht was this meeting after Kristallnacht, but we now know that when FDR had a Jewish Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau Jr., who some of you may have heard of. In fact, his son today was until recently the long-serving district attorney of New York City, Robert Morgenthau. But Henry Morgenthau Jr. at one point tried, and he was one of FDR's closest friends. They had been neighbors in Dutchess County, New York, and he tried to push him in the last year of the war to do more to save the Jews of Europe. And FDR finally stopped him and said, don't pressure me on this. Always remember, you and your community are here by our sufferance. Now, we have this, and the reason he was pushing, we now know that there was an opportunity in 1944 for the Roosevelt administration to bomb the railroads to Auschwitz, as well as the Nazi death camp. The deportation of Hungarian Jewry to Auschwitz took place in the early summer and fall of 1944 until the end of the war. The bombing of Auschwitz would have saved probably 750,000 Jewish lives and another 150,000 non-Jewish lives. And we now know that Roosevelt himself vetoed this decision. And when Henry Morgenthau, his close friend, came to meet with him, surprised and almost outraged, that was when Roosevelt said, "Don't pressure me. Don't always remember that you," he was referring to you Jews and to another administration official who was a Catholic, "that you were," Roosevelt epitomized the WASP ascendancy of America. But the point was, Jews in the United States were fearful, perhaps, of doing too much, of speaking out. That's why, if we criticize, when I was saying that Pius XII did so much more, even Jewish leaders like Rabbi Stephen Wise, who's one of the great Jewish leaders of the 20th century. He was one of Roosevelt's closest friends. He had FDR's private telephone number. He could speak to him day or night at any time. The question is, why didn't Rabbi Stephen Wise organize in 1944 a group of Jewish leaders to meet with Roosevelt in the White House in October and say, "Unless you do something to save the Jews of Europe, we're not going to vote for you next month"? That's when 90% of the Jewish vote went to FDR. He didn't. They were fearful of alienating FDR and fearful of a resurgence of anti-Semitism in the United States. So once again, the moral of this is, the story is that there were very few people who spoke up courageously, and even Jewish leaders didn't at times when they should have. Maybe one
another more question here.
I'd like to ask a question. Is it true that Hitler had taken a decision to kill the Pope himself or have someone sent down to Rome to do it?
Yes.
No. All right.
Yes, it is. And we have documentation of it. It never came into being, but they had plans to do that.
All right.
Hi. Thank you for being here. And I teach at a public school in Madison and a high school. And I'll be teaching again World War II and the Holocaust. And I have a simple question for you. But a hard one. For your own children or for the kids of today, what would you say is the legacy of the Holocaust? What would you tell students? What's the legacy, the lesson they should learn about the Holocaust?
That would take another hour or two. I was going to say, the sad legacy is that, maybe that there's evil in the world and that not enough people have spoke up against evil. Maybe the answer to that, and I really think to really answer that, you I'd need a couple of hours, but you know, what I was just saying about this Rabbi Stephen Wise, you know, Elie Wiesel, the famous Holocaust survivor, said, you know, we often say the thing is never again. And, you know, it's not like never again should the world stand by and permit a Holocaust to happen. And the fact is, maybe the lesson was there were a lot of good people who didn't, for different reasons, didn't stand up and didn't speak out against Hitler, whether in Europe or in the United States. And, you know, now the Jewish community takes for granted, I'm speaking as a rabbi now, when it comes, delegations of rabbis and Jewish leaders will go and demonstrate on the White House, near the White House lawn even. We'll have protests, we'll meet with senators, meet with the president and vice president in the White House to talk about Jewish issues. If this had been done in the 1930s and 1940s, maybe more would have been done to save more Jewish lives during the Holocaust. I think the sad lesson is that, you know, it goes into the whole question of, I mean, you know, how did Hitler get elected? But, you know, we sometimes, the title of my book about the Mufti of Jerusalem is Icon of Evil. And, you know, sometimes it's politically incorrect to say that there's evil people. But the fact is, there is evil in the world. Hitler, Stalin, Ahmadinejad, Saddam Hussein, there have been evil people. And I think there has to be more moral courage for people to stand up against this. And what I'm saying about Pius XII is certainly, and that goes to Dr. Zola's question, he didn't do everything that could have been done. But nobody did everything that could have been done. He did a lot more than many other people did do. And that's what, and once again, in an age today, I think we appreciate moral heroism much more because there were few moral heroes during the Holocaust. Pius XII was one of them. And I think that may be one of the lessons. And also Winston Churchill, which is a whole nother talk. And, you know, I think the lesson is that we have to be able, the slogan never again, which has been popularized in different things, never again should the world, the Jewish and the Christian world, stand by and let a Holocaust, happen. And we live in an age of Ahmadinejads and others in which it's a pretty frightening age to be living in.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Rabbi, thank you. Question that I have is the state of Catholic Jewish relations in the United States has grown immensely over the past 40 years, especially with the works of Cardinal Keeler, Dr. Eugene Fisher, and a lot of the rabbi leaders in New York. And when the cause of canonization for Pius XII really arose, it stirred a lot of controversy, especially in Israel. I was wondering if you could give some context, if it's in your purview, to the current state of Catholic Jewish relations in context with the beatification or the cause for canonization of Pius XII.
Well, I would have to say that's a whole nother talk if you to invite me back again. I would say one thing: it's not up to the Jewish community or individual Jews, to canonize a pope. I mean, that's obviously, something that, that's the prerogative of the Catholic Church and the Catholic community. I would say, though, that if one were, and I know enough about Catholic theology to know that, that there are a lot of other, factors that come involved in the canonization. But the fact is that I'm hoping that books like mine will say for both Pius XII and John the 23rd, as well as I've written about John Paul II as well, that in terms of their moral greatness as moral and religious leaders, there's a lot to admire in their legacies. And I think that's been increasingly realized. But as to the whole process of canonization, I don't think I'll be asked, called.
I guess it was less about, there's a great sensitivity, though, however, to the maintaining the Catholic Jewish relations. And here in the United States, I was just curious what perhaps if you could give any insights or talk or ideas about the nature of Catholic-Jewish relations.
Well, I would have to say, without being, you know, that if you invite me back next year, I'll give another talk on, it's a whole much bigger subject. I think Catholic-Jewish relations are probably at a very great point, at a great, you know, to leave you with, could be another talk, but Pope John Paul II did more to for Catholic-Jewish relations than any other pope of the in history. And I think since his tremendous pontificate, and this is something I've written about also, he was the first pope to speak at a synagogue, at the great synagogue in Rome. He was at his own personal initiative, took the initiative to bring about the negotiations that led to the establishment of diplomatic relations between the State of Israel and the Vatican. So I would say that there's a lot to be encouraged about, and the greatest strides in Catholic-Jewish relations of the past century took place during the pontificate of John Paul II. And more than that, I think, would take another hour or two.
Thank you, Rabbi. I knew very little just before your talk, but one of the things I really didn't know about was his favorite cleric. I don't know what a Grand Mufti is, and what I'm wondering as you're going through your talk is, was there any, I don't know if it'd be Arabic or Islamic, outcry at the time, and was he like their Father Coughlin, or was he supported, was he speaking in a lone sort of maverick voice? Or was
a leader. He was the Mufti of Jerusalem, which was like the Ayatollah Khomeini, was the religious and political leader, ostensibly only of the Arabs, the radical Arabs of what was then Palestine. But he became the voice of the Muslim world during the aftermath of World War II. I'll recommend you to my other book. He, from Berlin, he spoke out on, he had a daily radio broadcast, a Nazi radio that was broadcast throughout the Muslim world, including Pakistan and elsewhere. And he became the voice of radical Muslims throughout the world during and for a couple of decades after World War II.
Well, that would answer the question of was it public then? It certainly was. What yes. about today? Is there anyone being like you today saying, no, the Grand Mufti was falsely accused and stuff? Is there anyone speaking out against and saying that wasn't the case? Or is it just silence?
I'm not sure if I understand your question.
You're defending Pope Pius XII, yes. as he had a lot of bad things said about. Is anyone doing that today in the Islamic or Arabic world towards the Grand Mufti, saying that
wasn't? Actually, not that I know of. I think, it's generally known that the Mufti was kind of an evil guy, evil figure. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know of any, I should say.
Okay, thank you.
Pardon my question, just as, my impression is that the lesson of the Holocaust is to be ever vigilant.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't travel. I haven't been to Europe, but I sense that anti-Semitism is much more of a problem in Europe than it is here. What are yes. your impressions of anti-Semitism around the globe, so to speak?
That I can answer to you. That's true. I mean, there's been a resurgence of anti-Semitism, and what's known as part of the Islamization of Europe, and in France, in Germany, ironically, today, there's less anti-Semitism than there is in France and even parts of England. If you want to read a truly frightening book, I'll bring to your attention, it's called Londonistan by Melanie Phillips, who's a Jewish journalist. She's a journalist in England who talks about the Islamization of London and the resurgence of anti-Semitism in England and in London in particular. In France, it's downright frightening. In parts of Europe, there's been, people said after the Holocaust it was a taboo, there would never be anti-Semitism again. Well, it is, there's been a resurgence of it. A lot of it has to do with what's called the Islamization of parts of Europe, Muslims outnumber Jews in most European countries now significantly, and there's been a resurgence of radical Islam in England and many European countries. No, I would agree to you. There still has been relatively less anti-Semitism in the United States compared to Europe. In Europe, one thought after the Holocaust, it could never happen again. And yet it is, it is happening again, and it's actually frightening. And, what's also surprising is there's been a resurgence of a Jewish community in Germany. Many people thought after the Holocaust, Jews would never return to Germany. There's now a tremendous Jewish museum, more than one in Berlin and elsewhere. And there's a rebirth of Jewish community in Germany also, and other parts of Nazi-occupied Europe. But what you're saying is true, but it's a different source of anti-Semitism. In England, it used to be the Oswald Mosleys, the English fascists. And by the way, it's very interesting, speaking of fascists, when Mussolini started in Italy, the fascist party did not begin as an anti-Semitic party. It was later when tried to cultivate Hitler. But in your question is, one of the frightening things on the world scene today, I think, is the growth of anti-Semitism, is a resurgence, especially in Europe. And, this is in a world in which Ahmadinejad is welcomed to speak at Columbia University, in a world in which it's considered politically incorrect not to give him a forum to speak at Columbia University, I think we have a problem. You know, Rudy Giuliani had the courage not to welcome Yasser Arafat to New York when he was mayor. And I think there, the idea, part of the ACLU argument that freedom of speech has no limits, I think, is now coming to be questioned. Some of you may be familiar with the Nazi march in Skokie that was already a few decades ago, in which Jewish lawyers went to court to give Nazis the right to march in Skokie, Illinois, which is the foremost concentration of Holocaust survivors in the United States. I think, as you said, we have to be more vigilant. And there's a famous phrase that's considered politically incorrect to use, appeasement. You know, Neville Chamberlain went to Germany in his naivete and came back and, his meeting with Hitler at Munich. He thought, we've learned one of the lessons, the woman who asked about the lessons of the Holocaust, is that appeasement of dictators, of people who are out to destroy you or out to destroy the world, doesn't help things. Appeasing Ahmadinejad or appeasing, whether it's appeasing Hitler, it didn't work for Neville Chamberlain. And that's why, by the way, Winston Churchill was one of the great heroes. He was chastised. He was a voice in the wilderness when he spoke up and said that you couldn't appease Hitler and you shouldn't appease Hitler in the 1930s. And maybe both of your questions, the lesson of the Holocaust is to be more vigilant and is to stand up against evil and against evil dictatorship.